Okay, guys, I've got an awesome recommendation for you. I've been looking for a smart, wearable piece of tech that I can use for fitness and health tracking and all that everyday use, but also something that's really great when I'm outdoors, having fun, going on adventures. And I have found it. It's called Amazfit. You might not have heard of them. I actually hadn't, but 42 million users have, so it's really well established. They make a ton of different smartwatches and bands and other stuff. But the watch I've been testing out is part of their adventure series, and it's called the Amazfit T-Rex 3. And I'm going to get into the tech stuff in a minute, but I just want to say it looks so cool. Even my missus has said to me, "That's a cool looking watch," and she knows what she's talking about, and I don't get those kind of compliments every day. But onto the nitty gritty stuff, when it comes to outdoor sports and adventure, it's got it all. It can track hiking, skiing, biking, running. It's got free diving. That's how much it covers, 170 sport modes and all. It's got all the usual health stuff, but check this out. The battery life is ridiculous. I've been wearing it nonstop for 10 days and haven't had to recharge it once. So it's perfect for adventure stuff, for traveling. I absolutely love it. Highly recommend it. So if you want to find out more, go to amazfit.com/armchair. And that's one word, A-M-A-Z-F-I-T. And when you get there, you're going to get 15% off your order. That's massive. So that website again is amazfit.com/armchair. The Amazfit T-Rex 3 is more than just a smartwatch. It's your personal guide to exploration, discovery, and the thrill of the unknown.
This episode is brought to you by United Airlines. When you want to make the most of your vacation, book with United. They're an airline that cares about your travels as much as you do. United is transforming the flying experience with Bluetooth connectivity, screens, power at every seat, and bigger overhead bins to help fit everyone's bag. And with their app, you can skip the bag check line, get live updates, and more. Change the way you fly. Book your next trip today at united.com.
Hey guys, welcome to Armchair Explorer. My name's Aaron Miller. I'm a travel writer and your host. And today we have the first of this month's immersion episodes. These are the episodes that we record on location in stereo surround sound. And they are designed, we hope, to give you a little glimpse of what it feels like to be there for real. And today's one I'm really proud of. It's the second of our series on Al-Lula in Saudi Arabia. Now, Al-Lula is an ancient city located on an enormous oasis in the middle of the desert. It was a key stopping point on the Incense Road. So it has this incredible storied history that until recently really wasn't known to anyone in the outside world. Jason, my producer, and I absolutely loved this trip. And I just want to say before we get going, you may have some preconceptions about travel to this part of the world, but I'm here to tell you, I hear that, I understand that. But from our personal experience of actually going there, our preconceptions were totally blown away and actually left me questioning, honestly, where those preconceptions came from in the first place. And on top of that, I believe firmly that travel has always been a way to connect people and a way to open doors and share ideas. And actually, that's what Al-Lula has always been about. It's always been a place that has welcomed travelers of all different religions and nationalities. And plus, the country is rapidly changing. You might not hear that side of this story, but it is. And I firmly believe that travel and exploration with an open mind is a catalyst for that change. So please listen in that spirit, because I think you're going to be blown away, just like we were. And a little bit more about the series itself. There's three parts to it, and each one explores the destination from the perspective of a different element. It's that kind of place. It's elemental. The heritage of Earth, the community of water, and today, the adventure of air. The desert is an incredible place for adventure. It just has this unique feeling, emotion that it gives you, which I think is really, really special. And we're going to have a lot of fun. There's hot air balloon rides over UNESCO heritage sites. There's Bedouin stars. There's screams. There's laughs and lots more. So get ready and enjoy the elements of Al-Lula, the adventure of air. So I am actually dangling 250 feet above a canyon, and I'm about to get dropped because this is what Alula is all about. It's got desert treasures, it's got 200,000 years of history, but it's also got adventure, and we're going to start our adventure by going through the air, by flying, by soaring. What better way to start? Are you ready? I don't know, but you're coming with me.
Are you ready?
Let's do this.
Safety off.
Safety off.
Countdown begin. Five.
Here we go.
Four,
let's do this.
Three, two, one.
But not quite yet. That's coming up later in the show. First, welcome to Elements of Al-Ula, Earth, Air, Water, and Fire. In this series, we're going to take you on a journey into the heart of one of the most ancient kingdoms on Earth. Located in the northwestern corner of Saudi Arabia, Al-Ula is an oasis in the desert layered in 200,000 years of human history. Each episode will explore a single element, the community of water, the heritage of Earth. And today, for our second episode in the series, the adventure of air, revealing a place still largely undiscovered by the outside world. These are the elements of Al-Ula.
So we have to reach exactly on that platform.
Oh my God.
So before start the activity, yes, it's a small trail and then small Via Ferrata.
We are at the Al-Ula Adventure Center with our guide Debakul, who along with Milesh and Adina will be taking us on something called the Giant Swing.
If you have any doubts, please ask me now.
Any doubts?
Yeah, any doubts.
From 1 to 10, how tough is this?
That question, maybe I will ask. I'll ask the same question after that.
He answers that when you're on the platform.
Yeah, I
can't
answer. Once you finish that.
Yeah, once you finish that.
That sounded like you don't want to know.
Yeah, exactly.
Traveling with us alongside our three tour leaders are a young Saudi couple, Yasmin and Ahmed from Riyadh, and Laura, our expert guide to Al-Ula, who you'll remember from episode 1.
How high is the cliff?
It's the center point is 80 meters.
So it's about 250 feet high, straight down a canyon, and there's wires suspended above it. And you're just making us look up now and walk up so that we're even more terrified. You're just building the tension now, aren't you? You're a total pro. Wow. Well, what are you thinking when you look up at that?
I think I'm going to lose my glasses.
Yeah. It's probably better that you don't see anything.
That's Jason Patton, the producer of the show. He'll be jumping with us today. Al-Ula's Adventure Center is set back inside an intimidating desert canyon. There's zip lines, rappelling, rock climbing, a 150-foot ladder suspended over thin air, screams echo through the valley. We hike up into a small gully that will take us to the top of the giant swing.
Okay, looking up and seeing the Via Ferrata for the first time. Little bolts, which are the handholds and footholds that you climb up. So it's like rock climbing. A little bit easier, but it doesn't look it.
So we will attach the green lanyard, which is connected to harness. The name of this connection is Zaza. This cable attached on the rock till the end. So you always connect it with the cable through your lanyard. Pass the Zaza like this, and it slide very slowly. If you fight with the Zaza, it may disturb.
Maybe because I fight too much.
Okay, don't fight the Zaza.
Yeah.
I'm clipped to the cable now.
Yeah.
So we're just coming up to the cliff edge. Starting the climb now.
Via Ferrata is a little like rock climbing, but you're connected the entire time to a cable bolted into the cliff. If you slip, your Zaza, which is like a special kind of carabiner, automatically catches you.
All right, up the first cliff. Woo. Get a little buzz as you go higher. There is a lot of exposure opening up to my right. So I look down the canyon and I look down at Laura. Looking down's fun.
After 50 feet, the cliff levels out to a narrow shelf that we have to inch around, stomach pressed to the rock wall for balance.
Wow, So walking along a little ledge now, and somehow because I'm not holding on to anything, it feels even more exposed.
At the end of the ledge, before we begin to climb vertically again, Debacle gets us to lean back over the cliff for a photo.
Oh my God, hanging back over the edge.
Yeah, like this.
Oh my God. Hands off the thing. In full free air. Free falling.
Nope.
Nope, wrong song to sing.
Then we reach something called the sky ladder.
Woo! That view is opening out to my right. Looks amazing. It looks like I'm climbing on a mountain on Mars. Black lava spill churning down the side of the gully next to me. Mouth is starting to feel dry. How are you feeling?
Yeah.
A lot of adrenaline. It's definitely getting a little dizzying now. I'm gonna try and climb this. There's a rope here. Little knots in it. I could pull myself up on. This rock looks fun for a little scramble. A little sandy, which is never good when you're climbing. But I'm gonna try and use my hands and feet and just climb it for real. Okay. Wow. When you climb something like this, exposure is an interesting feeling. You feel dizzy. And that's kind of what does you in. Because the higher you go, the more imbalanced you feel. And they say it's mostly in this kind of climbing, which isn't too technical, a game of mind over matter. All right. Whoa. Wow. As you come through the top, I get a view straight through to the other side of the canyon. We are so high. There are birds flying beneath us right now. This is amazing. What a view. Yeah. I'm getting all happy that we nearly made it, and then I remember what we have to do when we get to the top. This is the easy bit, yeah. Kind of the last challenge here. I can see the platform now. It's absolutely terrifying. It's so daunting. If you can imagine a high diving board, and then times it by about 50, and then place it over rocks, you've got something close to what I'm looking at right now.
At the top, there are two short sections left. First up, a wobbly suspension bridge with no sides, called, of course, the Indiana Jones Bridge.
Ooh, that's quite the chasm.
I'm gonna try and balance this.
Ooh!
Balance it? Yeah.
Oh, Miller.
Yeah! Gotta do it!
No hands in it.
No hands. And now, I've reached the point of no return!
That's actually what the last section of the climb is called, the point of no return. Because once you've crossed the bridge, there is only one way down.
Go, Ahmed! Don't
touch the gate! 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Oh my God!
He didn't know.
I can't believe what just happened. I know why they call it the giant swing now. It's like a bungee jump, but then it turns into a roller coaster halfway through. It's like a bungee coaster. Ahmed's now being lowered down to the ground.
Yasmin's next. She is visibly shaking.
Okay, I'm coming down. Thank you.
You got this.
See you at the bottom.
Do you say break a leg in this situation?
This is a mistake.
You definitely don't.
Now I can ask you that 1 to 10.
10! 100!
If you're
good to go?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Open your arms.
Okay? Okay.
Every time you see it, it gets worse.
When you imagine a giant swing, you might think of the playground version and then enlarge it. It's nothing like that. This swing begins with a free fall straight down towards the rocks before sending you at the last minute soaring hundreds of feet through the canyon.
I'm walking out on a platform over a cliff that is 250 feet down, and the nearer I get to the edge of this platform, the more my footsteps are slowing down. I can't make my footsteps go anymore. You know those moments where you sort of can't believe what is about to happen? I'm looking at my two friends that have just done it, yeah. And they are so small. They look like little ants with yellow helmets on. Laura, what are you doing to me, Laura? What, you enjoy torture? Now you tell me the start of our trip together? You know the pirates that used to have to walk the plank and there were sharks underneath them? They had it so easy, those guys.
Water.
They had to jump 10 feet into the water and get eaten by sharks. We have to jump off an entire canyon here. Oh, my mouth is so dry.
Wait, huh?
Everything locked up tight. You can tighten things more than you think you should. If you crush my head, that's fine.
Well, at least crush.
But here we go.
Woo! Look at that!
When you walk over the edge, huh?
Yeah. Oh, it's that changes things
totally
a little bit.
Totally different.
Here goes.
Jesus. I'm right on the edge now.
Stay here.
Okay. Oh my God. Okay, I've got one carabiner in. Two. That's two ropes, right?
Yeah.
So
what I'll do now?
Yep.
I'll tell you instructions.
Okay.
It's very simple instruction. You have to sit down.
Yep.
One step out, two step out, and you have to just, once you hang, you have to just hold the rope. That's it. Then I will talk with you.
Okay.
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 Till time, just relax.
When you say hold the rope, hold this rope?
I will
this one?
You will step by
okay.
Step.
Okay. One step at a time. Yes. Literally one step into thin air at a time. Okay.
So the safety is gone.
The safety is gone. I feel like I'm getting pulled forward here.
Your left hand on the pull.
Oh my God, now I'm leaning out.
Right hand on the other pull.
Oh my God.
Very good.
So one step out.
Very good.
Okay.
Right arm right. Orange.
Okay. Here we go. Got this.
Let's go, get on!
Oh my God, this is insane. This is flying.
Woo!
Hands free.
Woo!
Yes! Oh, that moment when you drop, it is free fall. What a rush. That is the scariest thing I've ever done. And it was amazing. Here we go. I'm being lowered slowly down now.
Oh, yes!
That's insane. I think that's maybe the most insane thing I've ever done.
Left your body for a second?
Yeah, my soul left my body. That is exactly what happened. I fell, my soul stayed up there. It was like one of those cartoon moments. Yeah. There's just a moment where you're like, Am I supposed to be free falling? Feet on the ground. I'm not too proud. I think this is one of the moments where you get on your knees, isn't it? And you kiss the ground. Mwah, mwah, ground. I'll never leave you again. I didn't know how much you meant to me.
Good.
That's awesome. Awesome work, guys. That was really fun doing that together.
And if you thought my scream was good, here's Jason's.
Can you do me a favor?
Yes, please.
Surprise me.
Five, four, three, two, one.
It's that he had the same thing we had, didn't he? Yeah!
And to top it all off, here's Laura's.
Two, one, lunch.
Biggest adrenaline rush I have ever had. Yalla, as they say here. Let's go. The element of air is often associated with that sense of freedom, that rush. But air is also life. It's the oxygen we breathe. In ancient times, the airy summits of mountains were the abode of the gods. There is power in the air, a presence. This episode is about adventure, but it's also about searching for that feeling. The next day, we rise in the still dark of pre-dawn and drive 10 miles northeast to an open plain on the edge of the ancient site of Hegra. Stars glimmer beside a crescent moon as sunrise breaks over the mountains of the Ashar Valley.
If I may have your attention, we will start the inflation with those big fans that you see on either side of the basket. They are very powerful, so we need you at a safe distance away from those fans during the inflation, please.
This is Captain Sarhan, our hot air balloon pilot, or aeronaut, as they're officially known.
Once I have the shape of the balloon, I start heating it up. The air heated inside goes light enough to lift its own weight, so it stands up. When it stands up, I invite you on board. The crew helps you out. You jump in from either side of the basket in your compartments. For landing, when there's no wind, balloons can come down almost vertically and touch the ground with very little weight. That's a very soft landing. There's nothing to do. When it's windy, it's more fun, more exciting. We call it a giggly landing.
Sarhan switches the fans on. We stand back and the balloon rapidly begins to inflate.
Wow.
Oh my. It's so much more powerful and bigger than I expected. Yes! The basket's lifting, the balloon's up, and the basket's lifting.
Oh, come.
Yeah, come on, Laura.
Inside the basket, there are four compartments, one for each of us, plus a center section for the pilot who stands directly underneath the burner.
Hurry, Jason.
Don't go. Where are you going?
Is it over to him?
Okay, come.
Nicely.
Okay, let me see the landing positions, please, for everybody.
Holding on to the handlebars, get my knees out.
Yes. Go back. Yes. Like this?
Like this?
Yeah.
All right. Slightly dubious if this landing position is going to save me.
Yeah.
The landing position is a little like the brace position in a plane, but facing backwards in case things get funny. We tie our safety belts on, the tether is loosened, and we begin to fly.
Here we go. Oh,
Bye-bye.
See you tomorrow. Wow, and we are off, we are floating.
The sun just came up, wow.
The sun is just peeking up above the ridge of the Ashar Reserve, the mountains, fields of date palms below us everywhere.
It's like the ocean of green.
Gianfranco, do you copy?
Oh, go ahead,
100 meters high, we have 170, 180 degrees. Take off with 6 knots, now we have about 11 knots.
We're actually lowering quite low down into this field of date palms now.
We see the dates on the palm
trees. We see the dates on the palm trees. We're coming down to about, I guess, 50 feet. We're almost skimming the top of the palm trees now. Listening to everyone waking up around us, the sunrise, the birds. Oh, we're making some friends.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Two little kids in the backyard of their house just jumping up and down and waving at us. It's so cute. I see some camels right down there in the middle of the date palm. Right there.
Oh, wow. Heading 150 degrees with about 7-8 knots.
That is wild. It is so hot underneath that, isn't it? It's absolutely crazy to be in this place to do it too. Like, there's not many more beautiful places in the world than this to do it. Just incredible.
Riding a hot air balloon is incomparable to any other mode of transport. There's no motor, no resistance. You are literally part of the air, utterly silent and still, interrupted only by dragon bursts of sudden fire.
So how do you fly? Can you explain to us how you fly?
It's actually the difference in temperature between inside the balloon and the outside.
Okay. So right now you're holding on, there's different wires and cables and strings that you're holding on, and you...
This is just so that we don't get bored.
Actually, they're quite important, but it's as much art as it is science. The wires hanging from the canopy open vents that spin the balloon left and right. The burner, whose 15-foot flame heats to over 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, controls the altitude. The hotter the air, the higher you rise. But that's it. For the most part, you are simply reading the wind and riding the currents of air.
210 degrees with about...
We're floating higher now. You really get a sense from up here as well, the stark contrast between the desert and the oasis. It's this incredible contrast of color and life. We're floating higher now and heading towards Hegra and the rock formations that we began at the early light, just as dark black forms against the ground are now lighting up in 3D and color and shading in with beautiful pastels of orange and red and yellow. But looking out towards the sun where it's rising, it's still hazy and you get that gorgeous misty morning sense and feel. And the higher we go, the wind's kicking up more. I can feel the wind on my face. I can feel the heat from the fire. And every time that fire goes, we rise just a little bit higher and see a little bit further into the horizon, into the distance. I thought when we started this episode, the element of air would be all about adventure. What I'm absolutely mesmerized by is when I'm floating here above this incredible world wonder of Hegra, it's absolutely still and quiet. I could hear my breath.
The first of the decorated tombs will be actually at the end of that flat top rock over there.
Yep. Yeah, I see the first one just coming through now. You can see it carved in. And it's so small. When you're next to it, it's absolutely enormous. But here, it just looks like little sand paintings.
The monumental rock tombs of Hegra, carved by the Nabataeans 2,000 years ago, are perhaps the most breathtaking sight in the whole of the Alola Valley. In the previous episode, we explored it from the ground. There, the intricately carved facades tower above you. But from here, they blend into the environment in such harmony, it's as if they've grown organically from the stone itself.
Beautiful formations, aren't they?
You can see Red Mountain over there.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you can, yeah. We're approaching Jebel Edlib, this one. So we'll go over it like this.
Okay.
Really good direction. And then after it, we'll see the Tomb of Lahian appearing as well.
It is astonishing. Jabal Almar, the Red Mountain, where a necklace of precious dates was discovered inside the tomb, preserved after 2,000 years. Jebel Hinnat, the women's tombs, doors with eagles guarding, a carved stairway leading to the sky. Jebel Itleb, the Diwan, a sacred place for meetings and ceremonies.
Look where our shadow is.
Yeah.
You see, we passed by this little, like, there's something on top of that.
Yeah.
That's actually a tomb from the Dan Kingdom.
That's a tomb of
Yeah, so
oh,
it's a...
see it built right on top of that.
It's a tomb of a guard.
Huh.
And you can see how from there he would have seen all vantage points of entry points.
Fire is just echoing through the canyons like a dragon.
And there's really no need to whisper. I mean, but it's the sort of place where it feels like you should whisper. There's a kind of reverence to floating above. It's surreal as well, isn't it?
It gives you a sense of the...
Wow.
Wow. Look at this. Doesn't get much better than that. Sunrise in Hegra, soaring above the desert.
The scale of the site becomes evident here too. 111 tombs have been discovered so far, spread out across 6 square miles of open desert, and many more lie in wait.
The sky has always been the abode of the gods, hasn't it? So maybe it's fitting to be floating over the tombs of Hegra. it's something I didn't expect about this, that something very, I'm going to use a word that's completely inappropriate, but there's something very grounding about this. You know what I mean, though?
Yeah. You're kind of in an element that's not your element.
Yeah, but just feel completely safe in it, you know? Yeah. Like when we did the swing, you're nervous, you're scared, yeah. You feel gravity all around you, pulling you down, but here it's... Gravity. I thought I would feel like that, but I don't feel like that at all. I feel completely safe.
Famous last words.
Please take your landing positions.
Are we doing a giggly landing or...
Yes.
Landing positions, all right, and then crouch down, brace. Oh, we've got 10 feet off the ground now. Looks like we're traveling faster the closer. It's like a...
Oh, hold on, buddy.
Three. Brace ourselves. Oh! On those strings, we're getting tipped backwards. What was I saying about calm meditation?
Yeah. Hello.
Hi, guys.
How are you doing?
Hello. How are you going?
We are upside down. Yeah. We're looking up at the sky now.
Looking at your back of your head.
Hello.
And the sky and a balloon.
Hi. So I've just crash landed in a balloon. How are you doing?
Oh, yeah.
That was actually pretty cozy.
Yeah.
How are you going?
I'm gonna stay here for a while.
Until he tells me to let go. Oh boy. I see why you made me take the equipment down now.
You can come out as well, Lauren.
This is why you call it a giggly landing, isn't it? This is it. It's so funny.
Oh my god. All right. Well,
what do we do now?
This upside down podcast.
Yeah, very serious.
And there will be more giggles and bounces coming up soon. But first, something unique. Because the element of air carries more than just balloons and stillness. It carries sound. If you're a regular listener to the show, you'll have heard me shouting about a clothing company called Doer, as in built for doing. I really love this partnership because I genuinely love their clothes and they're perfect for the kind of thing that I think we as a community are looking for. First off, they are super comfortable, super stretchy. I go for a lot of walks in the day, mainly because my dog is a master at making me feel guilty. And these things honestly feel like I'm wearing hiking pants / trousers. Secondly, and no offense to hiking pants, they don't actually look like hiking pants. I want to wear something to work that looks cool and feels like I've made a bit of an effort. And they do. I love their style. And they've got a ton of great winter all-weather jeans that are water and windproof. So you can still get after it no matter what the weather. And check this out. If you roll up the bottom of the legs, there's even a reflective strip on some of their jeans for riding your bike home safely after work or presumably tearing it up on the dance floor. How ingenious is that? So go ahead, do what I did and upgrade your denim with Doer. You can check out their flagship stores in LA or Denver or just shop online, shopdoer.com, explore. That's D-U-E-R. And right now, if you use that URL, you are going to get 20% off your first purchase, which is massive. So remember, it's shopdoer.com/explore. That's an awesome deal. So don't wait. Get that 20% off. Get doing. You won't regret it. I highly recommend it. Check it out. shopdoer.com/explore.
Ryan Reynolds here for, I guess, my 100th Mint commercial. No. I mean, honestly, when I started this, I thought I only have to do like 4 of these. I mean, it's unlimited premium wireless for $15 a month. How are there still people paying 2 or 3 times that much? I'm sorry, I shouldn't be victim blaming here. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/save. Whenever you're ready.
$45 upfront payment equivalent to $15 per month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Taxes and fees extra. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes. See details.
I'm excited about this. I've never even heard of sound bathing.
Ready?
Oh, this smells beautiful. I mean, insects put all around me right now.
Please enjoy.
Okay, we will.
Alula has always been a place of refuge, and because of that, it was also a place of healing. We've come to the Habitas Resort in the Ashar Valley, which is gorgeous. Boutique villas spread out through a private canyon, an infinity pool in the desert, and something called a sound bath.
A sound bath is a kind of meditation where we use the singing bowls. This one is a crystal bowls and the Tibetan bowls to purify and to uplift your energy.
We are in the most beautiful setting right now too. It's right at the end of the canyon, surrounded by these beautiful cliffs on all sides, and we're in the sand on these beautiful mats, and yeah, thank you so much. I'm gonna lay down, I'm ready.
Sound baths are like an enhanced form of meditation, but instead of focusing on your breath, you're immersed in deep resonant sound waves that fill every corner of your mind. Laid out before Credine are six singing bowls of different sizes, each one a different note.
Just close your eyes. Begin to relax your mind. Take a deep inhale and a deep exhale. And surrender everything to the universe. Every inhale, feel grateful for everything you have, and exhale, release all negativity. Connect yourself to the space. Now allow your mind to become aware of what is going on and stay on focus.
Notes grow and intertwine like vines, creating new patterns and textures of impossible complexity. It is hypnotic. Birds take flight. Wind swirls in the canyon. And light desert rain begins to fall. And then it all fades, and there is only the sound.
Bring your hands in center. In sharing these things, there is no difference between us. We are one. We are the same. We are united. Once you feel ready, you can gently open your eyes.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
We've been there for half an hour, and it felt like 5 minutes. Afterwards, Jason and I walked to a quiet spot at the end of the canyon. He wanted to record some bird song and the sound of the ambience of the desert there, but we couldn't get the experience out of our head.
I thought that was so powerful. Did you get something from that?
Yeah. Let's talk about it for a sec. It felt like nature was like part of the soundtrack in a way.
Yeah, I kept kind of coming in and out of being really focused on the sound, but there were moments where I just felt like all there was the sound. There was no other, like, mind. And it would only last a second, and then it would disappear. It was like a wave coming in and out. It just sort of filled up. It felt like it filled up my whole mind. Like, a lot of the time, I realize that a lot of the time, I find it quite hard to shut my mind down. You know, even if I'm somewhere amazing and really enjoying it, and I'm aware that I'm finding it amazing, but at the same time, there's a part of me that hasn't fully let go to that. Like, there's a commentary, there's a person talking the whole time. And if you can just let that go for a second,
the actual experience is just so rich, so much richer. You can't hold on to it, but just for those moments, you get a glimpse of what it could be.
The first time the music shifted minor and shifted dark, and the thunderclap almost on cue echoed through the valley, the voice went, "That was too perfect." And then the next time, when the flock of birds took off perfectly framed behind her, and again the voice spoke up and said, "Wow, did you see that? Did you hear that?" The third and fourth time, I realized and I thought, stop thinking about how you're appreciating it and let it happen.
And I also felt like somewhere where people have shared ideas, where people have been welcomed, where people have come to rest for thousands of years, that must stick around somewhere, you know? And maybe if you're still enough, you can pick up a little bit of that too.
I think it's the other way around, personally.
Yeah.
I think it's not that good intention and goodwill and friendliness sinks into the place, but that the place brings it out of the people.
Yeah. Maybe it is literally because it is an oasis. It is an island of life in the desert, that there's something about that that just kind of draws you in. And I found that the sound made it easier. And sound is a physical presence in itself. Here's an actual sound wave that I'm interacting with, vibrating at this frequency that makes my actual brain waves resonate at that same frequency. That's how sound works, and that's pretty incredible.
Finding resonance with literal resonance.
Yeah. Yella.
Air is the messenger of sound. Whether singing bowls, shifting sands, or echoes of canyons and caravans past, it's not empty. Like the desert, the air is rich with possibility. Alula has always been a place of healing, where traders could rest after their long and weary journeys. But that healing also comes from the desert itself. There is a boundlessness here that stills the mind. The last stop on our journey is about 90 minutes outside of town in Garamil. But Laura has a surprise for us on the way.
I love that sound. Osama, how's it going, my friend?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very, very good. Where are we? Because this is the most beautiful desert I've ever seen.
Yeah, this is Wadi Alfan in Al Ula, in the middle of Al Ula.
This is Laura's friend, Osama, and we're standing in front of the coolest off-road car I've ever seen.
So actually, I love this car from the high school and started driving off-road. So I like the driving and how you're feeling when you drive in the sand and rocks and different area.
And Laura, I was going to say, you've got a bit of a secret as well, because...
Yeah. I actually have the same car. This is a vintage Toyota Land Cruiser from 1981.
And it's so cool. It's sand desert color. It's got the white top, got that vintage style, but it looks like just a rugged beast that will take us anywhere we want to go. So we're going to have some fun. Obviously, the desert used to be camels, used to be the mode of transport, but Laura, you've upgraded us now.
Yeah, exactly. And look, we get to sit in the back seat. We go in from the back. We have to climb into it.
Yeah.
And we sit like looking at each other.
It's like right? a miniature living room in the back of the Land Rover. But it's also like, it's going to be like a washing machine when we get going.
For sure.
We're going to shake bouncy. It around. You can make it as bouncy as you want, Osama, my friend. We're going to have a great time. So, yeah.
Be careful what we wish for.
Be careful what you wish for. All right. Alright, yalla! Let's do it! So what's the secret? How do you do it? I've never tried to drive off-road in the desert before. What's the secret?
The first thing you should do it in your car when you go into desert, make the tires pressure low.
Okay.
And then make sure your 4x4 it's working. You don't really want stuck in the sand.
Is it easy to get lost if you don't know
your way around here?
Yeah, it's easy. Actually, before 12 years ago, I get lost and stay 12 hours in the desert, lonely, and the car is stuck.
How did you get out when you got stuck?
Use your head and never leave your car. Usually, when you drive in the desert, you have to be focused on this road because you don't know what.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
What you're gonna find?
Some drifting going on here.
Yeah.
So, Sama, how old were you when you started driving?
13
years old.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I stole my grandfather's car. It's a pickup truck.
I knew it.
So go in desert and do the like donuts. Yes. So sometimes he wake up and see the car is dirty. I washed it last night. So why this car is dirty? So I said, I don't know.
And he still drives like he's just stolen the car.
Yeah.
Oh my god, the door's open!
Hold the door! Hold the door!
So we stop here or going another area?
Keep going and just have fun.
Yeah. Okay. I thought you never asked.
We slide down 100-foot dunes, drift screaming around corners, and creep up impossibly steep sandbanks, peering backwards as if we're being pulled up a roller coaster.
Very steep and rocky place. This seems to go on forever. Looking down into that canyon. Oh my god, that's beautiful. Over there, it's like this one. Especially from above, but we can see it actually now from this vantage point. It's like a big fish with like stuck in the sand dune. From above, it looks like a swordfish fin.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So cool.
Desert fish.
This is like the perfect time to be doing this too. The light is just gorgeous.
So guys, enjoy the views and let me drive.
You got it.
Wadi Alfan translates as Valley of the Arts, and while we were there, preparations were being made for Desert X, an art exhibition held actually in the desert itself. And the theme for the event this year is In the Presence of Absence. That's exactly what it feels like to be here. Beyond the screams and drifts and giggly landings, there's a power in the emptiness of the desert that perhaps only art can fully explain. Well, maybe poetry. The poetry of the Bedouin and the stars.
So my name is Bedriya and I'm going to be talking today about the sky. I have a great love for the stars and now I'm going to teach you what I've learned from living here for months in the desert. Isolated, I learned to navigate with the stars, I learned to tell time, and everything I learned was through what I took from the Bedouins of this region.
We've come to a remote location in the Garamil Desert. The sky is pitch black. There's no light pollution. Bedriya is dressed in a thick Bedouin cloak. We lie on the sandy ground, an ocean of stars glittering above.
So here in El Garamil, the landscape is very unique. However, for the rest of the Arabian Peninsula, it's almost completely flat desert. As far as the eye can see, it's just sand and sky. And it stays the same. You can travel for days, weeks, months, and the landscape won't change. There's no mountains, no rivers, no forest. So the feeling of being in the desert, the feeling of being completely isolated, living your entire life on a blank page, was the experience of the ancient Arabs.
The deserts of the Arabian Peninsula were one of the harshest places to live in the world. And that brought with it unique challenges. For the Bedouin to survive, they needed to be able to do two things. First, they had to be able to find water.
Imagine how difficult it must be to navigate in a desert. If you were living anywhere else in the world, and you wanted to get from point A to point B, it would be easy. I'd tell you, sure, just go straight until you see a forest, then turn right when you see the mountain, then follow the river, and then you're there. However, imagine, again, living on an empty canvas in an environment so unforgiving that even your footsteps are wiped away by the sand. The people that survived were the Arabs because they unlocked the secrets of the desert and they were able to navigate.
The second challenge was time. They needed to be able to tell time to know when to plant crops, when to harvest, when to save their water and store their food. And all of this, they had to do in a place where almost nothing changes. The secret to both was in the stars.
They understood every color of every star, the movements, the brightness. They understood the sun's path, the moon's path. And because it started as survival, every part of society knew it. Every man, woman, and child knew astronomy by heart. It was so interwoven in their daily conversations, their jokes, their stories, that they never had to teach it. Understanding the sky, navigating with it, and telling time was as easy to them as breathing. Even today, 49% of the names of the stars are in Arabic. And even if you look at the oldest Italian manuscripts, or the oldest Persian drawings, or Indian etchings into clay, you'll find that those Arabic names of stars exist in that history. And that's how I know where it all started. It's because we needed it to survive. And that's why it was ours. In fact, there is a saying that Arabs would say whenever foreigners would come to their land and ask them, how do they know so much about the sky? They would reply with, وَكَيْفَ لَا أَعْرِفُ سَقْفَ بَيْتِي. And how do I not know the ceiling of my own home?
As a nomadic people, the ancient Arabs wrote little down. Knowledge of the stars was preserved in stories and poetry passed down from generation to generation. But that doesn't mean it wasn't precise. Reading the stars was a matter of life and death, and the observations they recorded were every bit as accurate as the math that would follow.
However, the sky moves differently every day. So every day, these stars rise 4 minutes earlier than the day before. So every single day, the sky shifts a little. So because of that, in 6 months, we're going to see a completely different sky. Half of the sky is still underneath us, and the other half is above us. So in 6 months, it'll switch. So that's why every night we have different stars to see, and we have different stars based on the seasons. So imagine you're lost in the desert, and you're dying of thirst, and I tell you, I'm going to save your life. I'm going to give you a map, and you're going to be able to navigate. And then that map starts to move. It would be impossible to navigate. So in order for the Arabs to understand the sky, they had to have one reference point. They had to have one star in the sky that never moved.
The North Star, in Arabic, Al-Jedi. But it's actually quite difficult to find. It looks just like any other star. The ancient Bedouins located it through stories that bounded the constellations together into an unchanging narrative. And one of the constellations they used to find it was Cassiopeia. In Arabic, Dat al-Kursi, the enthroned one.
So essentially the story of Cassiopeia is that she's a very, very beautiful woman, or a beautiful queen, but she's also very arrogant. So all she does all day is she sits on her chair and she looks down at us all. So you're going to see a side profile of a chair. And what you do wherever you are, whenever you are, is you look for Cassiopeia, you take her knee, and then you draw it straight down until you hit a star. So that star is the North Star. And it always exists because Cassiopeia will always be here. And then all the other stars rotate around it. So whenever you're lost in the desert, you find the North Star, and then you know that that's north. But another really interesting thing you can know about the North Star is where you are on Earth. So we know that the way that we study the Earth is through latitude and longitude lines, right? So we have latitude lines that divide the Earth horizontally, and we have the longitude ones that divide the Earth vertically. The line in the middle, the zero line, 0 degrees, is called the equator. Then we have 0 to 90 degrees all the way up, and 0 to -90 degrees all the way down. So again, say you're lost in the desert and you want to know where you are on Earth. So all you have to do is you take one arm and you point at the horizon. Then you take another arm and you point at the North Star. So what angle am I making with my arm? What's that?
30.
30, 27 to be exact. You were very close. So if you look at our coordinates right now on Google Maps, you'll see that here in El Gharamil Desert, we're on degree 27 north. So this also acts as you can understand where you are on Earth. So that's navigation. And they became so precise with this knowledge that they could find a well of water in the desert. Imagine the scale of a well of water in just this desert, El Gharamil Desert. If you didn't understand how to navigate precisely, it would be impossible to find. It's like if I took my ring off and I threw it in Europe and I asked you to find it.
They became such masters of this knowledge that they could navigate to within 2 feet. That was their margin of error, simply by drawing geometry in the stars.
So again, the way that they remembered the sky was through stories. Legends, romance, revenge, murder, all of these stories existed in the sky. So right here, you can see that there's a very angry looking star, right? It's reddish or orange, and it's flickering very brightly, right? So for the Arabs, when they looked at that star, it inspired passion in them and tragedy. And that's why that star is called Aldebaran. Aldebaran in Arabic means to follow closely in someone's footsteps. So for thousands of years, Aldebaran follows Al-Thuraya. But Al-Thuraya has never once looked back. And that's the tragedy of their story. So Aldebaran is known as the lover that has never been shown love back. And what's interesting is the moon's path passes exactly between Aldebaran, which is the star, and between Al-Thuraya. So every night, the moon passes right next to Aldebaran, and Aldebaran asks if he can marry Al-Thuraya. So he proposes to Al-Thuraya through the moon, and then a few hours later, the moon moves up, it goes to Al-Thuraya, it passes on the proposal, but every night Al-Thuraya refuses. And this story has continued for thousands of years. So there's actually an Arabic saying that describes this relationship, and it goes, "Awfa min al-Dibran wa aghdar min al-Thuraya," which means if one side is more loyal than al-Dibran, then the other side will always be more treacherous than al-Thuraya.
Al-Thuraya is the muse of the night sky. She's mentioned throughout Arabic poetry, often simply as the star. She doesn't even need a name, she's so famous. But the way that she's described depended on the time of year.
So say you're looking at Al-Thuraya now, right? And you're looking at her in the east. So you're looking at her as she's rising. So for example, if you were to read a piece of Arabic poetry, and they said she was as beautiful as a pearl necklace, that would mean that these Arabs wrote this poetry in the winter. And that's because at the beginning of winter, Al-Thuraya is rising. So if you look at this shape here, it looks like a pearl necklace. However, if I said within my poetry that Al-Thuraya is as beautiful as a teardrop, or is as beautiful as an earring, which are also some things they used to describe her, that would mean that she's traveled all the way across the sky and she's upside down. So it depended on how they romanticized the things in the sky. You as a reader are able to decipher where they are in the year. And there's another star, a very, very important star. It's very, very bright as well. So that star is called Suhail in Arabic. And Suhail is very important because he's down towards the south. So the way that they distinguished between Al-Jadi and Suhail is through a story called The Four Daughters. They're also known as Ursa Minor, the Little Dipper, the Little Bear. So this story of the four daughters, they're carrying their murdered father and they're rotating around the North Star. So for thousands of years, these four daughters refuse to bury their father. And the reason why they're doing that is because they're accusing the North Star of murdering their father. But of course, we know that the North Star never moves, right? We know that it's standing in his place and he's confident. In this story, that means that he's innocent. The real murderer of the fathers of those daughters is that star there. Because he only shows in the winter and he makes a small leap over the horizon. So anyone that kind of goes very far away and hides and you only see them rarely, that's probably the behavior of someone that's guilty. So that's why that's known as the guilty star and that's known as the innocent star. So the sky is filled with these stories.
Teardrops of lovers in summer, the murderers of fathers in winter. The poetry of the stars is what allowed the Bedouin to thrive in one of the harshest places on earth. Waqif al-Arif fo Saqfa Bayti, the ceiling of their home, is the map beneath their feet and the clock on their wall.
So I'm going to conclude this with what I think is a very interesting modern story. So Aramco is the biggest oil and gas company in Saudi Arabia. But not many people know the backstory. So the way that Aramco was initiated is there was an American oil and gas company that wanted to dig for oil in Saudi Arabia. So they sent their engineers and their equipment and they started to map out the desert. However, because the desert is so mysterious, it was very difficult for them to find anything. And they searched and searched and searched for 10 years. The American companies almost went bankrupt because of this search. So after 10 years of looking, they ran out of money, they ran out of time. So they decided to ask the Bedouins how they understood the desert and how they navigated. But eventually they found one man. His name was Khamis bin Rabthan, and he was very clever in the way that he was able to communicate to these Americans how they used the stars to navigate. But of course, telling American petroleum engineers to follow the stars, they're going to think you're crazy. So before they followed his method and before they mapped out the desert, so they asked him to prove that this worked. So he told them, today we're going to leave our base camp and we're going to go deep into the desert. 5-6 hours of traveling. And suddenly he stopped them and he asked them to come out of their cars and he told them to take one of their spare tires and to bury it in the desert. And he promised them that the next day, when they went back to their camp, he would draw a straight line from where he was standing all the way to the tire, and he guaranteed them that they would find it. Try to imagine how tremendous of a task this is. Remember the metaphor that I said about taking my ring off and throwing it in the middle of the desert and asking you to find it? Imagine if I buried it, how difficult that would be. But he knew he was going to find it because this method was honed over thousands of years of his ancestors finding wells of water. And of course, the next day, right before sunrise, when the sky was still dark, he drew a straight line from where he was to where he knew that the tire would be. And so when the sun came out, they traveled with their cars until he asked them to stop, to look under their feet, and of course they found that tire. Of course, because he found it, he became their master navigator. And even today when you look in the offices of Aramco, you'll see a framed picture of an old, wrinkly Bedouin man standing with his camel and holding a telescope. His traditional knowledge is what saved them. And that traditional knowledge still inspires us today. So as you look up, try to remember that. Try to remember that what we're looking at right now is exactly what they saw thousands and thousands of years ago. This, what you're seeing here, is the exact same sight that they saw. This silence is the exact same silence that they heard. This cold, the air on your face, this is the pure, unfiltered feeling of being in the desert. So I just want you to keep that with you. And thank you so much for listening to me talk.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stripe knows that the difference between making and missing a sale could come down to how your customer wants to pay. Maybe your customer prefers paying with Twint or Ideal. Well, even if you didn't know, those are popular payment methods in Switzerland and the Netherlands respectively. With Stripe, your checkout will. Stripe's optimized checkout suite intelligently offers up localized payment methods and drives 11.9% in additional revenue for businesses on average, turning more of your shoppers into buyers. Learn more at stripe.com.
In Alula, the element of air is found through adventure, because it is through adventure that we connect most deeply with the natural world. It makes us scream, it makes us giggle, it makes us walk the plank and kiss the ground beneath our feet. But it also binds us and connects us to the land. It heals us and lifts us up. There is presence in absence, power in emptiness. There is music on the wind and poetry in the stars. That is the spirit of the desert, and that is the element of air. Shukran, thanks for joining us on Elements of Alula, the adventure of air. Next time, we'll be exploring the community of water and stepping back in time with the Festival of the Ancient Kingdoms. And if you're interested to find out about how you can do everything that we've done today, go to experiencealula.com. At experiencealula is the handle for Instagram, Facebook, and X. And a very special thank you to our travel companion and guide, Laura Alho, for her expert knowledge and insight. Connect with Laura on Instagram at Blue Abaya. The Elements of Alula was produced by Armchair Productions, the audio experts for the travel industry. Jason Patton did the field recording and production. I'm Aaron Miller. I wrote and presented the show. I'll see you next time.
Do you love hair-raising, allegedly true stories about the paranormal? Then summon the podcast Scared to Death. It's the popular horror series with more than 60 million downloads and is co-hosted by me, Dan Cummins.
And me, Lindsay, co-host and also Dan's wife. Each week on Scared to Death, we share bone-chilling tales from old books and creepy corners of the web and some submitted by our listeners, all designed to make you sleep with the lights on.
Think you can handle the horror? Tune in to Scared to Death every Tuesday at the stroke of midnight to find out.
I'm Whit Misseldine, the creator of This Is Actually Happening, a podcast from Wondery that brings you extraordinary, true stories of life-changing events told by the people who lived them. From a young man that dooms his entire future family with one choice, to a woman that barely survived her roommate, we dive into what happened and hear their intimate, first-person account of how they overcame remarkable circumstances. Follow This Is Actually Happening on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts, or listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.